This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.
Crime Stories with Nancy Grace.
From day one, I knew you were something special.
He saw the video of her wedding.
There's a body. He appears dead.
I had quite a journey to get to you.
16 bullets.
A motive for murder.
He's been bubbling and brewing and simmering.
Just pure hatred.
It was his final dominance and triumph.
If I can't have you, no one else will.
On December 30th, 2025, at approximately 10:04 a.m., Columbus Police Patrol officers were dispatched to the 1400 block of North 4th Street on a well-being check. Officers arrived at scene and located the two adult victims suffering from apparent gunshot wounds. We now know that they were identified as Mr. Spencer Tepe and Mrs. Monique Tepe. Their two small children were also found in the residence, physically unharmed.
Who would murder a husband and wife in their own home around Christmas, leaving their children, their tots, upstairs to come down the next morning and find mommy and daddy dead? Everybody and their brother was calling 911 about the dentist not showing up to work and the wife not picking up the phone. Police go to the scene but see nothing. Listen.
I would like to ask for a wellness check on an individual at their home. This individual, Spencer, works with me and he did not show up to work this morning and we cannot get a hold of him or his family. He is always on time and he would contact us if there is any issues whatsoever. And I just don't know how else to say this. Like, we're very, very concerned because this is very out of character. And we can't get in touch with his wife, which is probably the more concerning thing.
When Dr. Spencer Tepe doesn't show up for work at Athens Dental Depot in Columbus, Ohio, coworkers are so shocked, they call their boss, the owner of Athens Dental, Dr. Mark Valrose. Valrose is on vacation in Florida, but Spencer not showing up is so unusual. Coworkers felt the need to let Valrose know. Valrose tries to contact Spencer, and failing at that, Tepe's wife, Monique, as she's even more predictable than her husband. Unable to reach either Tepe, Valrose calls 911 in Columbus, Ohio at 9:03 a.m. requesting a wellness check.
What's the emergency there?
Our boss did not report to work. We haven't been able to get a hold of him for 3 hours. We are on site and we can hear.
Okay, I just talked to somebody there.
Okay, I'm just making sure somebody called.
Officers arrive at the Tepe residence at 9:22 a.m. Officers knock on the front door multiple times but get no response. Checking the door and windows, officers see no sign of disturbance. At the back door, officers again knock multiple times, no response. Repeating the process, officers fail to get a response and file the report in their logbook, no response.
So all these 911 calls are coming in. The dentist hasn't shown up. Why are they that upset about a teeth cleaning or a cavity being filled? Let's listen to more.
Okay, we do have officers responding there. Do you know if he's been ill or anything like that?
No, I was just visiting yesterday.
What's the emergency there, police or medical?
Maybe both, I guess. I don't know.
We had a call out there. They knocked on the front door and back door multiple times, and there was no answer.
Yeah, no answer. I can hear kids inside, and I swear I think I heard one yell, but we can't get in.
Straight out to investigative reporter, journalist, author of Down the Hill, My Descent into the Double Murder in Delphi. You know her well, Susan Hendricks. Susan, thank you for being with us. So I'm not sure. I'm just playing a selection of 911 calls to dispatch. Who's getting more and more PO'd? That's a Latin phrase from law school. And they're like, we sent somebody, they left. Nobody answered. But then you've got neighbors and coworkers now all walking around the house, and they hear a child screaming inside, and the dispatch officer just really was just too busy doing her nails.
Absolutely, Nancy. You could hear it in her voice and her pauses even. I was listening to all the 911 calls, and she's thinking, he's just late for work. She has a preconceived notion about what's going on here, but the first call is what is a bit odd to me. It came in around 8:58. The office opens at 8 a.m. Spencer lives about 73 miles from work. So if you put the timeline together, he's what, less than an hour late to work and someone's calling 911 for a wellness check? To me, that stands out.
Right now, my mind is stuck on the neighbors and the coworkers walking all, they finally go to the home. Now remember, dispatch, while she's doing her nails, has just stated, we sent somebody out there, they knocked on the door, nothing happened. Okay, listen to this.
Another friend calls 911 and tells the dispatcher they haven't been able to get into the house, and he thought he heard one of the children yelling. Other friends arrive at the Tepe home, as well as co-workers who are walking around the house, some in the front, some in the back. 911 dispatch is receiving calls back-to-back from the same address, each trying to get help for their friends, not knowing others were calling at the same time.
What's changed since the last person I talked to?
There's a body.
There's a body inside?
Yeah.
Okay, hold on 1 second. Let me get you on the line with the medic, okay? Stay on the line.
He appears dead.
There's a body inside? Wow. Talk about egg on her face. Let's hear the rest of that 911.
There's a body. Our friend wasn't answering his phone. We just did a wellness check. We just came here, and he appears dead.
Okay.
There's blood. He's laying next to his bed, off of his bed, and there's blood. I can't get closer to see more than that.
Okay. So you can tell he's obviously not breathing or anything?
Yeah.
Is it like kind of like puddle, like, you know, does he look like...
It doesn't look puddled. I can't look.
Okay. All right. Understand.
Tom Smith, veteran NYPD, now star of Gold Shields podcast. Tom, the casings were found on the scene. I believe 3 casings. What does that tell you, Tom? No weapon. And that's why they're saying it's not a murder-suicide, because how can you shoot the spouse and shoot yourself and the weapon, what, walk out the front door? So it's not murder-suicide. What do you make of the casings?
Yeah, the casings are interesting because I don't think, you know, it's been speculated a couple of times that it's a professional hit. A professional is going to take the casings with him. The fact that they're left there is just someone who did what they wanted to do. And I do believe this was a targeted hit, and then just got out of there when they could and weren't concerned about the casings. But the casings are so vitally important in this because of the DNA evidence you can take from it.
Joining me right now is a military vet sharpshooter, Koa Lorimar. Koa, thanks for being with us. Very quickly, I want to follow up on what Tom Smith just said. Explain to me how, show me how DNA can be left on a casing when loading a gun, preferably a 9, but any gun.
Well, Nancy, this right here is a 9mm round. The top part is the bullet, and the back part is the casing. Now, you can get DNA off this casing by fingerprints and sweat and whatever else they have on their hands when loading the weapon. So this is how you load magazine right here. And also, there are certain marks that are left on the casing after the round is fired. Now, this is the pistol, a pistol that this round can be fired from. The bullet goes out the front and the casing is ejected out of the side. Now, the firing pin leaves a mark on the back of the casing, which is unique to the weapon. Then the extractor leaves scratches on the casing, which is also unique to the weapon. And the ejector leaves dents on the casing. Now, all these marks can be traced straight back to the weapon it's fired from, and that could link the suspect to the gun. Can also link the suspect to the casing based on the fingerprints they get off the casing itself.
Okay, I see what you're saying, Tom. Thank you, Koa. Who would shoot these two dead? That doesn't sound like a pro to me. In the home, in a very congested neighborhood, the houses are like this, up and down, like 2 and 3 story, not wide, but tall. And they're one after one after one after one after the next. So there's got to be a Ring doorbell cam. And I'm going to show you the video of who may be the perp. This could be the killer. Susan Hendricks, describe what are we seeing here? Why is this significant?
I have to say, Nancy, that what appears to be a back alley of sorts, and this is at, of course, an odd time, 2 to 5 a.m. It appears he knows the area because you see him kind of ducking or maybe knowing there's a camera in the vicinity. Is that the guy? If it is, it looks like he knows where he's going.
Dave Mack joining me, Crime Stories investigative reporter. Let's talk about the video. Susan's already told us it was between 2 and 5 a.m. And how does that jive with the time we believe the killings went down?
Based on the timeline that police have already created, Nancy, they say that they're talking about 2 a.m. to 5 a.m. as the time that this action took place inside the home. And that timetable we're looking at for the guy walking in the alley is during that time period.
I'm curious about the neighborhood. I don't see anybody else walking around between 2 and 5 a.m. See the person walking? It looks like people park their cars as you pull in front of the house. See, on both sides of the street, I see cars parked in front of the homes, like where you put your trash out, right there on the street. They look to be condos or 2-3-story narrow homes. So why is he walking up and down in a residential area at 5 o'clock, 2 o'clock a.m.? Susan, what can you tell me about the neighborhood?
I do know that there's only one bar in the area that's open because Spencer's brother-in-law came out to say, like, hey, let's not jump to any conclusions. Maybe it is the murderer, maybe it's not. And there is just one bar that's open at that time. So was he there? I'm sure the investigators are going there to decide. It just seems odd, right? This street looks very different, by the way, Nancy, as you stated, during the day, during normal hours. It appears he knew this route, knew what to do and planned it, in my opinion.
You're seeing video of the home from our friends at WSYX ABC 6. So this is a residential area. Who is this guy walking up and down right near the home? It's obviously caught on Ring cam. Looks to me like that's what that is. Dave Mack, what can you tell me?
Actually, Nancy, the Nest video is captured behind the home. There's an alley. You mentioned how these homes are very close together and going straight up, right? Well, this is actually behind the home. It's in an alleyway. And to what Ms. Hendricks just said a minute ago, somebody walking down that alley between 2 a.m. and 5 a.m. is going to be very familiar with the neighborhood to know where they are and where they're going in that alleyway.
That neighborhood video from WSYX ABC 6. Tonight, new evidence of an eerie door-banging riddle near the scene of the murder. How can that help me prove who committed the murder? First of all, let's hear that 911 call.
What's the emergency?
Somebody's knocking on my door. I think they're trying to get in. They're banging on my door.
Okay, someone's banging a knock-in. Do you know who this is?
No.
Do you have a description of them?
No, I can't see any faces.
Have you told them, have you asked them what they want or if they need something?
No.
Does it never end with these dispatch officers? What does she want the victim to do? Go out and say, hi, come on in. By the way, what's your name? And can I get a good ID on you right now? Completely, completely not helpful. Also, it's 11 days before the dentist and his wife are murdered. It's right down the street from the murder scene. And also, it's around 2:30 a.m. So the comparisons are starting to add up. Two things coincident. Three things, there's a pattern.
Columbus police respond to a domestic dispute call at the Tepe residence a few months prior. Officers later report the couple tells them no physical violence occurred and that police assistance is no longer needed.
Much has been made about a prior, we think, domestic call. What does that mean? That means typically a man and a woman are arguing within a residence and it's coming to blows. Is it connected? It's from this home. It's from the home of the victims. Let's listen to it.
Hello?
Hi, this is 911. We just got a hang-up call. Is everything okay?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm okay.
Are you sure?
Yeah, I'm okay. Sorry.
Okay, well, it sounds like you're crying. Do you need police, paramedics, or anything?
No. I'm okay. I'm just emotional. I'm okay. I don't mean...
Okay, can I ask what had you call 911 in the first place? Like, were you having an argument with somebody?
Me and my man got into it, but I'm okay, I promise.
Did anything ever get physical?
No.
You guys were just arguing, nobody hit each other?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. All right, ma'am. Well, I have the information here. I can go ahead and tell the officers to cancel hitting over to your address there.
Yes.
If
yes,
anything changes, call us back.
Okay.
All right,
I'm sorry.
Finally, a 911 dispatch officer that sounds interested and like they care about what happens. Now, Susan Hendricks, there has been some discussion that is not the murder victim, Monique.
Absolutely. Spencer's brother-in-law, married to Spencer's sister, came out right away and said, if you know Monique, you know it's not her voice. They like to have parties, people over. And it was apparently, he said, a woman who was at that party made the call, I believe he said right outside of that home, but that it wasn't Monique and it had nothing to do with them and that they had a great marriage. So saying that had nothing to do with them.
You know, another issue, Tom Smith joining me, former NYPD. What would have been the motivation at 2:00 in the morning at best to bam on a door just to shoot somebody that's unconnected to you? That seems far-fetched to me. This seems like it was more targeted. What would you be looking for at the scene, Tom?
Yeah, well, we know there's no forced entry, so that is concerning. So they either let themselves in because they knew the passcode, because they've been at that residence before at the numerous parties that this couple had, and it's somebody they know, or they knocked on the door, and one of them answered it, and they were forced back into their bedroom. So one of those two things happened. The entry of just getting in is still unknown. And that's what, you know, part of this investigation is going to be. Another telling sign is the children not being harmed and actually the dog who is in the residence not being harmed as well. So I agree with you. This was, in my mind, an absolute targeted hit of one of these two individuals.
This was a targeted domestic violence attack that resulted in the deaths of two people and irrevocably changed the lives of their children, families, colleagues, and friends.
What could be the motive?
Investigators get all available surveillance video from the Tepe neighborhood, focusing on the time between 2 a.m. and 5 a.m., and release video of one person walking in the alley behind the Tepe home. Police believe that person is Michael McKee. One car with an Illinois license plate arrives in the neighborhood shortly before the Tepe murders take place and leaves shortly thereafter. The license plate on the vehicle is registered to Michael McKee, a vascular surgeon in Chicago. McKee is also Monique Tepe's ex-husband.
Wow, it wouldn't be the first time that a vehicle has been the giveaway. Straight out to Dave Mack, a Crime Stories investigative reporter. I noticed that in some of the details, the fine print and what we have learned, police are not saying what evidence was found in the vehicle, but they are stating that they have evidence that he, McKee, the starter marriage husband, was in the vehicle in the hours preceding the murders. What do you think it is?
They have evidence that Michael McKee was in control of his vehicle during the time before the murders took place and in the time immediately following. So you've got him tied directly to the vehicle. We do not know exactly what evidence that might be, but we don't have a 9mm gun. We got shell casings. So maybe that's what they found in the car. But they did find enough evidence to prove that he was in control and the only person in control of that vehicle in the minutes before and after the murders took place.
Detectives filed warrants charging Michael D. McKee, 39, with two counts of murder and the deaths of Spencer and Monique Tepe. Mr. McKee was arrested in Rockford, Illinois without incident. He's currently incarcerated in the Winnebago County Jail and awaiting extradition to Columbus. We believe at this point we have the person responsible for the murders of Monique and Spencer Tepe in custody. And that person is Michael McKee.
Dave Mack, is it true that vascular surgeon Dr. McKee was arrested at Chick-fil-A?
He was, Nancy. The guy is just acting like there's nothing going on, just a regular day at the races, and he pops into Chick-fil-A to get his favorite lunch snack. That's where he was actually arrested, and the ATF was there on site, Nancy.
Why did the ATF arrest him?
It came down to a lie. Dr. Michael McKee lied on a federal form when he purchased a handgun in Nevada. He provided a false residency form of information, and that immediately triggered the federal jurisdiction for firearm violations alongside the state murder charges. So the ATF was brought in because of the lie about where he was living when he filed for that gun.
Crime Stories with Nancy Grace.
Multiple weapons were taken from the property of McKee. And there is a preliminary link from our NIBIN to one of the weapons that ties it to the homicides.
Did you find any other evidence in his home in Lincoln Park?
What I can tell you is that we did search his property and we have evidence, but I can't speak to any specific evidence.
They've got evidence. They were observed lugging box after box after box out of vascular surgeon Dr. McKee's penthouse apartment there at Lincoln Park. Straight out to a special guest joining us tonight, Koa Lorimore. Thank you for being with us. Former Army sniper, sharpshooter, I want to talk to you about the weapons. You just heard Columbus Police Chief Elaine Bryant state that there is a preliminary match from evidence found in the home, i.e. the gun. I don't know where they found it, in the home, in the car. Doesn't matter for your purposes. But they've got a match to the bullets fired at the scene. Were they lodged in the body? Did they ricochet off the wall? Were they stuck in the wall? Were they stuck in the mattress? Were they stuck in the floor? Doesn't matter. They're saying they've got a match. Now, before I get to you about how that match is deduced, I want to talk to you about how difficult would it be for the killer to engrave or write on the bullets? How would you write something on the bullet?
Well, Nancy, you could take a Dremel tool and then you take the casing of the bullet like I have right here, and you could basically just engrave whatever you want on that casing. But I think you would have to have a special kind of hatred to go to the lengths of engraving something on that.
Agree. Now, let me ask you this, Koa. What if we learn the defendant, the surgeon, Dr. McKee, created his own ammunition? Yes, people actually do that. That would leave a trail a mile wide if you created your own bullets. How do you do that?
So you need a special machine that they use to create a bullet like this. And then you take all the components. You take the primer on the back, the casing, obviously the gunpowder inside, and then the bullet, and you press it all together. This is common practice with like precision shooters, people that do it for sport. Pretty uncommon just for your average guy.
Dan Murphy joining us, former NYPD Detective Sergeant, co-star of Gold Shields podcast and author. Dan, he had to drive 325 miles, if he came from his home, to get to her place that she shared with her husband and children. There's no way he didn't leave a trail.
Absolutely. His cell phone is going to be pinging off cell sites all along that route. And if you look at it on a map, you can trace his route. He's also probably having to stop for gas, bathroom breaks, whatever it is along the way. So he left a footprint. He made purchases. He got food. He did something along that way. I don't know if there's any toll roads there, but it's almost impossible to drive 300 and something miles across America without leaving a digital footprint and probably CCTV coverage from a variety of different places.
Now we learn about a silencer. Come on, I can't wait for the defense attorney, bring it on, to tell me this was not premeditated. To Susan Hendricks joining us, investigative reporter, journalist, and author, of a bestseller, Down the Hill, My Descent into the Double Murder in Delphi. Susan, many people didn't know about the allegation a suppressor was used, which requires a lot of forethought, right? You've got to match it to your gun. You've got to set it up. You've got to get it. Who needs a suppressor? Who needs a silencer? We learned about it in this indictment. Tell me about the indictment.
Yeah, Nancy, and that's an excellent point. He did plan it out according to this indictment, charged with 4 counts of aggravated murder, and 3 counts of the aggravated murder include exactly that, having a silencer. And the 4th one includes just brandishing or showing the firearm. It appears he planned more of what to do rather than the aftermath of it.
Monique Tepe married vascular surgeon Michael McKee in August 2015, but separated as a couple after just 7 months. The couple had no children. Monique stated the reason for the divorce was they were incompatible. After living separate and apart for a year, divorce proceedings began in May 2017, and the divorce was final the next month.
Oh my stars, they blinked their eyes and the marriage was over, and they were living separately during it. Dr. Bethany Marshall, that happened, I think, 10 years ago. It was 10 years ago. Monique has moved on. She's married this dentist. They're totally happy. They have 2 babies. What? And now, out of the blue, can I tell you something I found out, Dr. Bethany? Brace yourself. So, in the divorce, McKee claimed her engagement ring and wedding ring were his, and she had to pay him back for that. And then there was a miscellaneous balance of $1,200. And he said, if you don't pay me back that $1,200 by X date, you're getting charged 23% interest. I think I know why she left him.
Well, that gives us insight into the marriage. I mean, Nancy, think about it. The first 7 months of a marriage are the time of heightened idealization, where you see nothing wrong with the other person. They are on a pedestal. So if a marriage breaks off that quickly, something is really, really wrong. And given Monique's history with the current marriage, it's not Monique.
At this time, we know the state is building its case against vascular surgeon Dr. McKee. Just think about this guy. He excelled in everything he did. That's his mugshot. He excelled in everything. He played football on a very high level in college. He was Dean's List honor student in undergrad. He was a star student in medical school. He went on to become a vascular surgeon, certified to practice in multiple jurisdictions. Just before the two, Monique and her husband, are shot dead, he gets sacked with a malpractice suit, a pretty serious one, and another claim that one patient actually lost his because of McKee. Very serious complaints. And then he ghosts everybody. He leaves that jurisdiction and disappears to where even a PI can't find him, and just starts all over again in another jurisdiction. Could he move that surreptitiously? Which leads me to, how long had he been surreptitiously stalking Monique? There she is, Monique, and the first starter husband, Michael McKee, the vascular surgeon. It was just for 7 months. It was nearly 10 years ago. And he brewed and bubbled and simmered and stewed for nearly 10 years till he makes an over 300-mile trek to shoot her dead in bed with her husband, her children in the room next door. This is what we've learned. Listen.
She was terrified because he had threatened her life on multiple occasions when they were married. She wasn't shy about talking to people about traumatic experiences that she had with her ex and just how emotionally abusive he was to her. If any of us had known that these threats were actually grounded in possibility, we all would have acted differently. Myself and many others were well aware of kind of the negative impact that he had on her. She was willing to do anything to get out of there.
From our friends at NBC and GMA, that is the brother-in-law, Rob Missel, speaking out. Dr. Michael McKee turned murder defendant ex-girlfriend speaks. Let's listen.
He did tell me a little bit about his divorce at the time. So, and again, I want to preface this with, this is his side of the story and what he spoke to me. This is not truth. This is obviously very biased. But what he told me was that one day he came home from residency and that Monique had vanished. Like, she took everything. She left the house completely empty and also took their dog. He was just left very stunned because he didn't see this coming. And he was, like, completely devastated.
This is a woman who I believe to be a medical doctor that says she is McKee's ex-girlfriend. She seems reliable and credible. And in a moment, you're going to see photos of her with McKee and her family.
He didn't really talk about his parents. He did tell me he was adopted by an older couple. And he just, like, they were good parents, but he just never talked about them. He never talked to them. I would call my mom, like, every day. We have a great relationship, but he was just much more reserved. He never really, when I asked him more, he just didn't really want to talk about it. So I kind of left it at that. This is him. This is us celebrating New Year's with a bunch of my friends and family. And this is me right here. And that's him, which is crazy.
Okay. So if she's lying, she's gone to great lengths to Photoshop pictures, which look very real to me. Listen.
He also has been to my family home. That's him right there. This is me and my family members. But it's honestly shocking, and I'm grateful that the Lord protected me from moving forward in that relationship.
The ex-girlfriend has now deleted her TikTok. She was at TikTok at S. Rummy.
In a dating profile on Bumble, McKee refers to himself as Mike, claims to be 32, and in the About Me section writes, "Lucky to have work I find meaningful and increased free time for new things. Currently trying hot yoga, way less flexible than I recall. Planning trip itineraries to finally make use of global entry and hopped on an electric motorcycle. Haven't died yet." He also says he wants children someday.
Now, in the dating profile, he is beaming in the photograph, showing off his tan, suggesting a real outdoorsman, wearing a lilac sweater over a white button-down, posing, for some reason, with a kid's lunchbox, which shows the name Mike and a dinosaur. I guess that's because he's Michael and asked people to call him Mike. He talks about how he wants children. But he's alone. He's running from multiple lawsuits, including one guy who had to have his amputated, another guy claiming he had a part of a catheter stuck in his left shard, stuck in his leg, ouch, after surgery. So he's alone, running from lawsuits, running from process servers, and he watches this over and over. Look.
From day one, I knew you were something special. I had quite a journey to get to you. Countless bad Bumble dates, wrong relationships, and waterfalls of tears. But it was worth every cringing second because it led me to you. Throughout all of this, I knew that God was guiding me to my person, and that when I met him, it would be the most magical thing ever. And boy, is that an understatement. I finally found my lobster, and it honestly couldn't be a person with a more beautiful heart. I will love you forever, and I'm so lucky to be Mrs. Tepe.
Dear Momo, I feel so lucky to be up here with you today. You've grown to become my best friend, and together, we're surrounded by friends and family who are fortunate to be able to say the same. We're so lucky. Our support system is immense, and you embracing Larry, my crazy group of friends, and my loud family like you have means the world. I vow to support you, to believe in you, and to encourage you. I vow to provide for you. I vow to never stop loving you and to always keep working on us. And lastly, I vow to do my best to always keep making you laugh because your smile is my favorite thing. I love you.
How many times, Daryl Cohen, will his digital footprint show me? You're the veteran trial lawyer. If he looked at that even once, I get to play it in front of the jury.
That's all we need, Nancy. That's all a prosecutor needs. And what are we going to see? A motive for murder. A motive to destroy his ex-wife, to destroy her husband, and at the same time, destroying their kids.
Let's go straight in that courtroom where the ex-husband of 7 months, 10 years ago, waltzes into court. Let's take a look. That from our friends at WBNS10. I'm about to go to Franz Borghardt, veteran criminal defense attorney, trying to figure out how much money I and the rest of the taxpayers are spending on this guy that now has to be extradited. Probably with how big of a fleet of security? What are they going to do? Give him first-class service? Is he going to get a warm roll and a drink with that? Let's watch that one more time. Again, from WBNS10. Did you see that, Borghardt? Did you see that? He's perfectly sane. He knows exactly what's happening, and not a flicker of emotion on his face. Not one ounce, not one drop, one scintilla of remorse.
Pesky Constitution, Nancy. He's presumed innocent. I guess he should just roll in and say, "You got me. Let me save you a bunch of time."
Okay.
No.
Did I ask you that? That's what we call under the law, in case you've tried a case. Unresponsive to the question. Not one ounce of remorse. He has simmered for 10 years. Then he goes online and he sees his wife's wedding video and he can't stand it. Let's go back into court and take another look at it.
Have you had a chance to speak with him?
Yes, Your Honor.
What's your position at this time?
Yes, at this time, Your Honor, on behalf of Mr. McKee, I will assert his right to counsel. I will assert his right to remain silent. And Mr. McKee believes that the most expeditious manner in which he may defend himself against the charges pending in Ohio and to plead not guilty would be to waive his right to an extradition hearing and to have a governor's warrant and to agree to his immediate transportation to Ohio.
Understood. Thank you. Thanks, everyone.
That from WSYX ABC6, also in the courtroom. In the meantime, during our last live chat, during the airing of our program, a viewer noticed this. Do not discount any evidence as being insignificant. Let's see. Okay, watch him walk. He pulls to the right. He pulls to the right. One more time in the courtroom video. He pulls to the right. When he walks to the right, to the right, to the right, there he goes and stands, goes to the right. Now, that's from WBNS 10 TV, our friends there. Now, let's look at the video. Well, to the right, to the right. He pulls to the right on every step. Now, we've just gotten in video of Dr. Michael McKee's book him. There he goes. There he goes. See it? Let's see that again. That was very... That may be the... I don't know what causes that. He does not have any football injury. He played varsity football at an elite level, I think, in college. There he is in his bookend. This. Right here. You know, he just looks like any other dude walking around in his flip-flops at the pharmacy, the kind, you know, just... But to think that he could have unloaded a full mag on Monique. Irv Brandt joining me, former senior inspector, U.S. Marshals Service, International Investigations Branch. Irv Brandt, I want to talk to you about extradition. You have traveled all over the world tracking people down. How hard do you think it was to track this guy down? He might as well have run home and hidden under his mother's bed, for Pete's sake.
Nancy, from what it appears, being an the ex-husband, I don't think it took the authorities much time to identify him than track him, because it doesn't appear that he went into hiding. So they arrested him relatively quickly.
You know, Irv Brandt, I don't think nearly 2 weeks is, quote, relatively quickly. Maybe his plan was to blend in and act like nothing happened. But he led law enforcement on a wild goose chase for nearly 2 weeks. He covered his tracks. He parked away from the crime scene. He hid his face. He did elude police for nearly 2 weeks. Does nobody watch true crime? Reportedly, the monster surgeon blurts out an alibi before he immediately invokes his right to the Fifth Amendment, but it's too late. He's busted in a lie. Joining us, an all-star panel, but first, straight out to Crime Stories, investigative reporter Dave Mack. What happened?
Nancy, it seems as though before his arrest, police actually got up with Dr. McKee and asked, hey, where were you on this particular night on December 30th? Not an uncommon thing to do with an ex-spouse. And his story, Nancy, is that he had booked a room at his hospital where he's a surgeon, OSF St. Anthony Medical Center in Rockford, Illinois, and that that's where he was the entire night. Investigators are able to bust that wide open.
Joining me now, the investigative reporter for The Mirror and The Irish Star, Yelena Mandenberg. Ruh-roh. Oh, what a tangled web we weave when first we practice to deceive. Busted! What happened, Yelena?
Well, he left his phone at the hospital and he booked a sleep room at the hospital where he's a surgeon, which would be a normal, believable thing. Many, many doctors do. He left his phone, which we assume allegedly, if he went out there, was so it doesn't ping off the cell phone towers and so everything looks legit. However, all investigators had to do was probably check the video feed and the surveillance videos from the hospital where he works. It's really easy to overcome that alibi, even though it seems very legitimate for a doctor like him.
Hey, Dave Mack, I understand that you have uncovered an estimation as to how long that cell phone stayed in the hospital cot.
We know, Nancy, in this particular case, police were able to find out that Dr. McKee's cell phone was left in a cot at the hospital for 14 hours.
Now, how did this happen? Because I know he immediately blanketed himself in the Fifth Amendment, which is, of course, the right to remain silent. So how is it that McKee said a word, yet also invoked his Fifth Amendment privilege?
Any questions that were asked of McKee happened before they put the cuffs on him, before he's getting his chicken sandwich. So think about it, Nancy. As police begin an investigation, the first call is, hey, where were you? You know, your ex-wife is dead, and we need to know where were you during this time. We know you didn't do it, but, you know, we got to have it. And so that's where he immediately blurted, apparently, and that's where it starts, Nancy. He already locked himself in. And again, his phone being left in a cot for 14 hours kind of fits into the rest of the premeditation of this case.
And tonight, a careful reading of this affidavit reveals that Monique and Spencer's neighbor's door cam or surveillance video catch the so-called monster surgeon ex-husband lurking around their home while they're out of town in Indianapolis at a Big Ten championship game. Number one, how did he know they were gone? Had it been posted online? We know Monique had no social media presence. Was she afraid he was stalking her? I guess so. How did he know that? Had he hacked into their emails? That said, the neighbor's surveillance video catches him, Michael McKee, the vascular surgeon, once married to Monique like 10 years ago, stalking their home. We believe he gets in their home because that video shows him entering the, quote, curtilage. What is curtilage? Let's take a look at the fence that encloses the Tepe backyard, their back area. You can see that their backyard is totally enclosed by a fence. And if you look at this wedding photo that had been posted online, not by Monique, and I'm sure McKee looked at it many, many times, you can see how tall the fence is. This area would be the curtilage. This is behind the Tepe home. Straight out to Yelena Mandenberg joining us. What did you learn from reading this affidavit? What did you learn appeared on the neighbor's surveillance video?
Well, a number of new things with the affidavit. It's explosive. And since we're already talking about the alleged stalking that the neighbors caught on the camera, it was also the same day that they were at that Big Ten game. And Monique had gone home early. Her friends noticed she went home early in the second half because she was upset about something regarding her ex-husband. Neither she or Spencer went into detail with their friends, but they did let their friends know. So did she get a note from the neighbors, a text? Did she spot him on a camera, or did he send her a message while he was there to possibly psychologically mess with her? So we don't actually know how she found out, but we know she was upset about something that day enough to go home from a whole trip, from a whole game with her friends, to go home and deal with it. We actually also don't know if she let her husband know. If she realized that McKee was stalking her, we don't know if she let her husband Spencer know. She could have felt like she's managing this stalker. It could have been something that's happening frequently enough, because if we know that he went inside her home, the neighbors caught it on video, there's no police report. She never went to the police, even if she did know that he was getting into her home. And there is one line from the affidavit that especially stuck out to me that wasn't just illegal, but illegal and creepy. It's alleged, if true, she had told her friends that he had threatened her, you know, not just during their marriage and after their marriage, but at least once he said that he would find her by the house right next to her and that she will always be his wife.
McKee is spotted multiple times driving his silver SUV near Monique and Spencer's home before the murders. The vehicle has unique features such as a sticker on a window and stolen Ohio license plate. The registration for the SUV is linked to past addresses McKee previously lived and the hospital where he worked.
Dr. McKee's SUV is caught circling and circling Monique's home. Not just the night of the murders, but before that, many, many times. And then to make matters worse, his SUV is seized in the hospital parking lot while the good doctor is at work. Like, that's not embarrassing. He had scraped off a very identifiable sticker in between the time of the murders and the time his car, his vehicle, was seized. I understand his vehicle had a stolen Ohio license, as well as displaying at the same time an Arizona license. Like, that's not going to get the attention of the police. Dave Mack, tell me about Dr. McKee's vehicle.
You know, I don't think people realize that when you scrape something off, you leave residue behind. And it's not just that sticker that he scraped off that was so obvious, Nancy. It's the cumulative effect of all of the things associated with that SUV that is directly tied to McKee. You've got the stolen Ohio license plate. You've got the Arizona temp tag, both tied to McKee or former employers. And then that sticker. You've got this sticker on the vehicle that is tracked on video. They can see it. It's right there. They know the location of the sticker. They know what it is. And then when they find his car in the parking lot in Rockford, Illinois, where he works, oh, wait a minute. It's not there anymore, but we see the scrape marks where it was taken off in a hurry.
Crime Stories with Nancy Grace. Buried deep, deep in court filings, we learn that Monique Tepe was shot multiple times, not just Spencer, Monique as well, her children in the next room. Listen.
The autopsy report indicates Monique was shot 9 times, Spencer 7. Monique was shot in the right hand, right forearm, right side of her torso, 1 shot to the right cheek, and 3 gunshot wounds to the right chest. Spencer was shot in his left ear, left side of the neck, left upper chest, left lower chest, left hand, left upper back, and the right arm near the elbow. The injuries to Spencer's hand and right arm also could indicate he was trying to defend himself or Monique.
Yelena Mandenberg joining us, investigative reporter for The Mirror, The Irish Star, The Express. Yelena, what do we know? And we're learning this from the autopsy. It's called the coroner report there. And it's very disturbing from the Franklin County Forensic Science Center. What have we learned tonight, Yelena?
Well, as said before, Monique Tepe shot 9 times, while Spencer Tepe was shot 7 times, 16 bullets between them. The Franklin County Office of the Coroner determined that Monique Tepe was shot once in the face, 3 times in the chest, twice in the upper left arm, and once on the right side of her torso, once in her right forearm, and once in the hand. Gunshot wounds of head, trunk, and extremities with visceral, skeletal, and soft tissue injuries, says the report. In the autopsy, they were able to recover 2 bullet fragments left in the humerus fracture site, which means soft organ damage. It hit the lungs, it hit the liver, skeletal damage when the bones broke, when the bullets hit them. Spencer Tepe's autopsy says he suffered 7 gunshot wounds, also to the head, neck, trunk, and extremities with visceral, skeletal, and soft tissue injuries. Once in the head, once in the neck, 3 times in the torso, 2 times in the upper extremities, and a bullet was also recovered from Spencer Tepe's body.
Dave Mack, Crime Stories investigative reporter. Many people online want to know, were there holes in the wall? My deduction is unlikely. There were 16 bullets fired, right?
Yeah.
And they all made contact with the victims. I also think, although we don't know this yet, that he fired at close range. Think about it. There's the inside of the bedroom. So I guarantee you, he walked up to their bed, held out the gun like he's, you know, the antagonist in a movie, and unloaded on sleeping people. So they are close range. I don't know that they're going to be contact wounds, but I don't think he could have missed him. It's just like shooting a fish in a barrel, for Pete's sake, Dave Mack.
Nancy, I think you're absolutely right. There's not going to be any shots in the wall or the ceiling. I think you got 9 shots going into Monique. You've got 7 going into Spencer. That's 16 total. And they're going to be pointed down. Now, on the autopsy report, there is an indication of no stippling. So you're talking about an intermediate range. But, you know, one thing to think on December 6th when he was at the home, remember they were at the ball game? I think he went in there and he planned it all out. He walked around. He knew exactly where he was going to stand. He knew exactly where the bed was. He knew where they were going to be. And he had a plan, allegedly, to stand there and just standing over the top of him, he shot him. And look at the injuries. Right side on Spencer, left side on Monique. That's how we sleep. I mean, the only thing that really we can look at from this is that McKee knew exactly what he was going to do, exactly where he was going to do it, and then he did it, allegedly.
Joining us tonight, on behalf of Monique, Ariana Turner, a dear friend of Monique's. Ariana, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me. I'm blessed to be here.
You know what? I can see why you and Monique were friends. Because everything I've seen of her, everything that's been said about her, she had this just amazing, I don't know the right word, aura, demeanor. Tell me about her, Ariana.
She was just like indescribable, you know, like you don't really meet people who are just genuine, you know, and just genuinely want to help other people and just genuinely care about like just the people around them or just people in general. And like Monique was somebody who, like, if she cared about you, she was coming to check on you. She was doing everything she could to make sure that you felt supported and you felt like you didn't have, like you had somebody, you know? Like, she was just, she was an amazing mother. Like, she was just so, like, very loving, very bright, like, just positive all the time. Like, just a bubbly person. Like, just somebody you always want to talk to, like, if you're having a sad day. See, I mean, she was just one of my biggest support.
You stated that Monique was an amazing mother. Please describe that for me. I really want to hear this.
With her kids, she was just very playful, just very attentive, like, she just had this patience and this love for her kids, and she valued education, you know. And every time I've seen her with her children, it was always uplifting, her always saying positive stuff, even when she knew that they were doing something that they may have not been doing, just giving her baby love while also giving her direction.
When did you learn she passed on, and when did you learn Monique was murdered?
I was sitting with my fiance, and I was like, hold on, this cannot be my girl. He's like, that's her. And I lost it, like, I still can't process it, because how can somebody want to hurt somebody like her? Like, I just don't even see her hurting a fly. Like, do you see how beautiful her smile was? Like, she was just a radiating, like she was just a beam of sunlight. Like, I was blessed that I got to experience her here. But when I found out the news, I was heartbroken. I mean, I still am trying to process this tragedy. And it's like the details just get worse and worse and worse. How would you take them from us? You know, it will never sit right with me. And their babies were there. Like, that hit so close to home to me. And, you know, I've been through domestic violence. So the whole situation is very, very touchy, you know. But I don't have the right word, to be honest. I don't.
You know what? I disagree with you, Ariana, because I think your words are perfect. And the energy you have describing her, it's just something about her was just contagious. If you know or think you know anything about this case, please dial 614-645-2228. Repeat, 614-645-2228. Thank you to our guests, but especially to you for being with us. Good night, friend. This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.